Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with conflicting accounts of whether or not chemical weapons have been used in Syria, crossing a red line that the Obama administration has declared would invite a response. We will speak with an expert on chemical weapons and a former UN weapons inspector in Iraq, Raymond Zelinskis, who directs the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Program at the Monterey Institute for International Studies. Then we'll speak about Obama's state visit in Israel today with Dan Raviv, a national correspondent for CBS News and a veteran CBS Middle East correspondent who has written a number of books on Israel's intelligence community and blogs about it at israelspy.com. Co-authored with Israeli journalist Yossi Melman is Spies Against Armageddon, Inside Israel's Secret Wars, and we will discuss why Israelis are mounting protests during the president's visit, demanding that Obama free the American who spied for Israel, Jonathan Pollard. Then finally, we'll look into the second largest debt in the U.S. after mortgage debt, and that is student debt, that has tripled since 2004 and last week passed the trillion-dollar mark. David Halpern, who was the founding director of Campus Progress, joins us to discuss the role of the for-profit college racket in indenturing students with worthless diplomas and the impact of this growing burden on the millennial generation's future as their prospects of saving for retirement or owning a house or car grow increasingly dim. And joining us now is Raymond Zelinskis, who directs the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Program at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute for International Studies. He was a former United Nations Special Commission Biological Inspector in Iraq and is the author of Biological Warfare, Modern Offense and Defense, and his latest book is The Soviet Biological Weapons Program, A History. And he has an article in the National Interest called Preventing the Use of Syrian Chemical Weapons. Welcome to Background Briefing, Raymond Zelinskis.
Nice to be with you again, Ian.
And we have statements from President Obama is in Israel, and the President of Israel, Shimon Peres, has warned that we cannot allow Hezbollah to get hold of serious chemical weapons because it would lead to an epic tragedy. And then the Justice Minister, Tzipi Livni, who is formerly a very senior Mossad official in their equivalent of the CIA, she said it is clear to us here in Israel that chemical weapons have been used in Syria and an international response should be on the table. Now, that was refuted by a spokesperson for Netanyahu, but nevertheless, it sounds like, and of course, I can quote the House Intelligence Committee Chairman Mike Rogers of Republican Michigan, who says, I have a high probability to believe that chemical weapons were used. So, what's going on here? Did something really happen in Syria?
Well, something happened. There is photographs, vivid photographs, that was published by the Syrian news agency of victims arriving in hospitals. And it's undoubtedly that some of them were seriously affected. So something happened there, but whether or not it has to do with chemical weapons or with a conventional weapon, I don't think is clear at this point.
Well, the fact that the only source, or at least the principal source on this, is the Syrian government, the Assad regime, you have to take their word for it. And they are a ruthless regime, and they're quite capable of staging an event, killing their own people if they have to, and they certainly operate a fairly flagrant kind of propaganda machine. So wouldn't it be obvious, for example, if sarin was used, none of those workers helping those people out of ambulances, they'd all be dead, wouldn't they?
Including that's right. And that's, I think, is one of the curious aspects of these 11 photos that have been shown of the victims being transported or being in the hospital. You see a lot of people around them, first responders, and some are wearing masks, but they are of the medical kind of mask called N95, and they certainly would not protect against any kind of serious chemical weapons. And it's the same thing with the net. No, there's no personal protective equipment by any of the responders, and even the victims themselves do not have any kind of protection. and they don't have any signs that they have been decontaminated. For example, some of them look like they are wearing their usual street clothing.
But my understanding is with sarin that just a drop on the skin will kill you. And as long as that drop is there and you come into contact with it, whoever comes into contact will die pretty instantly. It's that lethal, isn't it?
Yes, all nerve agents are really dermally active. So yes, that's true. And also, you have to worry about clothing being contaminated, and then any first responder or any health provider could also then be contaminated from the sarin or the nerve agents that's on the clothing of a victim.
So if you touched a victim's clothes, you would probably die instantly or very soon thereafter.
Usually we say that. If they don't get treated within 5 minutes, they are pretty much gone.
So what are the other chemical agents that the Assad regime have that are perhaps less lethal than sarin?
For sure, mustard. But I think we can exclude mustard because that would cause blistering. And it just doesn't make sense in this kind of situation. They might have other like type of World War I gases, for example, phosgene or chlorine. And as a matter of fact, one of the Reuters journalists who is on site claims that he and also that victims smelled a chlorine smell.
And this was in the northern province of Aleppo, the town of Han al-Asal. It's supposed to have happened on Tuesday. That's in rebel-held territory. And that's what leads you to wonder whether or not it's the regime that's using it. What would the sense of the rebels using it in their own area?
That's right. We have to consider the weapon itself. And according to the Syrian government, it was a missile. So I would say that as far as I know, of the rebels, they wouldn't have the, first of all, Scud missile, and second, if they, for some reason, had captured a Scud missile, they wouldn't have the platform necessary to launch a Scud missile. So it doesn't make sense at all. So then the question is whether or not the Syrian government has launched one of its Scud missiles, and that Scud missile has gone asunder somehow and ended up injuring people in the zones that were or are occupied by the Syrian government forces.
Again, I'm speaking with Raymond Zielinskis, who directs the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Program at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute for International Studies. He's a former United Nations Special Commission Biological Weapons Inspector in Iraq and is the author of Biological Weapons, Modern Offense and Defense, and is currently writing a book on the former Soviet Union's biological warfare program and has an article at the National Interest, Preventing the Use of Syrian Chemical Weapons. Now, obviously, we're speculating here, but it would seem to me that, in fact, the White House made this warning to the Assad regime. They're saying that it's quite possible the Assad regime is sort of testing the waters, blaming the rebels for using chemical weapons, which would then give them the excuse of using them. And that could be the dynamic. And of course, the president has said this is a red line. So if a former senior Mossad official like Tzipi Livni said the red line's already been crossed, then what do you think's going on in talks between Obama and Netanyahu?
Obama has also said that the Americans are very busily trying to figure out what really happened. I just don't know how they're going to do that. But I think the interesting new development is that both sides, both the rebels, the Assad government has indicated they want an international inspection to actually determine what happened there. So the Assad government has asked or is in the process of asking Secretary General Ban Ki-moon to organize an inspection. And actually, there's a history there because past Secretary Generals have on 12 occasions investigated alleged chemical warfare events. Certainly Ban Ki-moon has the authority to do that and do so very quickly. The Syrian government then would be able to allow them to come very quickly. Now, the rebels would have a little different situation because, after all, they're not in control of the borders and so on. So the question is, who would they ask to conduct the investigation, and could they ensure that an investigation investigators actually are able to cross into Syria?
Well, it was the Russians who first broke this story, if you will, with the foreign ministry citing information from Damascus saying that the rebels had used chemical weapons causing deaths and injuries. And their statement was, we believe the new incident is an extremely alarming and dangerous development in the Syrian crisis. So the Russians have floated the story now. Then the Syrians followed with their so-called evidence, and the White House is skeptical. Nobody seems to have actually found any concrete evidence. And then there's this concern that this may be a pretext on the part of the Syrian government. How quickly then can you get some person in there to stand on this red line before, if it's already been crossed?
Well, it could be very quickly. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, OPCW, in Hague has inspectors that are there on call at all times. So they could be there within an hour. The problem there is that Syria is not a state party to the Chemical Weapons Convention. So the question is, can they actually call on the OPCW since they're not members of that? However, I think that the OPCW would be very amenable to sending people there very quickly. And those people could find out in an eye flash because they have very good detectors that could differentiate between the major types of chemical weapons in a matter of minutes. And then that's a first indication. And then they could then take samples that could be sent to reference laboratory for definitive identification that would hold up in, for example, a judicial court.
So Ray Zelinskas, again, a former United Nations Special Commission Biological Weapons Inspector in Iraq, is there any similarities with nuclear weapons in the sense that there's a half-life? How long would the evidence be out there if it was either a World War I type of device or the more lethal, more modern devices like sarin, which certainly seems unlikely, or even mustard gas?
Well, that's a very good question, Ian. I would tell you that there's a couple of considerations here. First is that there are what we call volatile chemical weapons, such as some of the nerve agents, sarin and tabun, and they would disappear in the environment very quickly. However, there are also chemical agents that are persistent, like VX, and that's another nerve agent that could stay around for days, depending on environmental conditions. However, there's another aspect, though, is that if people are exposed to even sarin, the more volatile ones, that can be detected in the blood and urine for days and maybe even weeks sometimes if you're dealing with skin and hair. So good sampling would really be worthwhile immediately to get an immediate indication for treatment purposes, but for legal purposes, the blood and the urine especially would be useful.
So, again, what real evidence would you have, or could the evidence be staged? I'm sufficiently cynical about that regime that they could possibly even poison people to prove a point if they felt they needed an excuse to cross the threshold. But on the other hand, you have to ask yourself, why would they want to cross that threshold and invite an international response from both the United States and Israel? And I suppose the most likely scenario would be for them to quietly hand over the weapons to Hezbollah without anybody knowing, and that's Israel's nightmare scenario. So walk me through those, if you will.
Well, look, if an investigation was mounted and there were clear indications that a chemical warfare agent, especially a nerve agent, had been used, that would automatically damn the Syrian government. I mean, they are the ones who are in possession of this. So however they want to use it against their own people or not, or if it was an accident, it would be a terrible situation for them, I would think. The so-called rebels are not going to have these kind of weapons available. They would really need to go into the depots, and would have to fight the Syrian regular army in a very well-protected depots, and I don't think that would happen. So any kind of detection of pure or real chemical weapons agents, I think, would be terrible for the Syrian government.
So does that mean then that they don't want Ban Ki-moon to come in?
Well, that's kind of surprising me that the Syrian government is actually requesting Ban Ki-moon to do this. If they are actually doing that, and if they allow an inspecting team to get in, I think that would reflect very well on the Syrian government.
Well, again, the speculation would have to be that they've got something to show that would indicate that rebels had used. I mean, I take it that it doesn't make sense since the government possesses this secret arsenal, but I'm just trying to do the logic test here, you know?
Yes, but there's this other aspect that if there was a Scud used, do you remember that the Iraqis used Scuds against Israel? They sent about 32 Scuds over, and there was suspicion at the beginning that the Scuds had chemical warheads, and that was quickly disproven. But the reason why there were suspicions about that is because of the fuel that's used to power the Scuds are very toxic and also gives off vapors and can be very injurious to people that are in the neighborhood of where Scuds land. So if the Syrian government actually used Scud against the rebels, or what they thought was rebel, but it may be misfired, what you actually have is this chemicals that powered the Scuds.
I see. So that's a very real possibility. Well, just in closing, Raymond Zelinskas, what does Syria have? It's supposed to have one of the biggest chemical arsenals in the world. What do you know that they have, and how much and how well protected is it?
Do I personally know? I would say that what our research has indicated is that they have mustard, and they have nerve agents, and then they have these incapacitants, in other words, the tear agents, the CS and perhaps CN. So it's not likely that they have large quantities of the World War One gases. For one thing, they're not as effective as the nerve agents, for example. So I think you really have to worry about nerve agents. And looking at the patients victims of this attack, I would say that you really are if there's anything, there would be nerve agents. Though for reasons I've already told you, having to do with decontamination and first responders not really being very well protected, it seems unlikely that nerve agents are involved.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Raymond Zelinskas.
Pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Raymond Zelinskas, who directs the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Program at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute for International Studies. He was a former United Nations Special Commission Biological Weapons Inspector in Iraq and is the author of Biological Warfare, Modern Offense and Defense. And his latest book is The Soviet Biological Weapons Program, A History. And he has an article at the National Interest, Preventing the Use of Syrian Chemical Weapons. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about whether President Obama is having a working trip or a photo op in Israel.
בבטן שאוכל לבלוע אותך אני
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dan Raviv, who is a national correspondent for CBS News and was formerly the CBS correspondent in Tel Aviv. He is the author of several books, including the 1990 bestseller Every Spy a Prince, The Complete History of Israel's Intelligence Community, Friends Indeed, Inside the U.S.-Israeli Alliance, and his latest, Spies Against Armageddon, Inside Israel's Secret Wars, all co-authored with Israeli journalist Yossi Melman. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dan Raviv.
Ian, a real pleasure to be with you.
And the president is in Israel. He's met with Peres. He's meeting later today with Prime Minister Netanyahu. He planted a tree from the White House, a magnolia, in President Peres' garden. Now, he's also visited the Iron Dome anti-missile site. But I guess the headline, if you will, is what's happening vis-a-vis the chemical weapons. It came up in conversations with Peres, where he talked about Hezbollah getting hold of chemical weapons and what a catastrophe that would be. And also the Israeli justice minister, former senior intelligence official Tzipi Livni, said it's clear to us here in Israel that chemical weapons have been used in Syria and that an international response should be on the table. Now, that's been refuted by Netanyahu spokesman Mark Regev. So what do you understand is going on here, Dan?
Well, okay, hi, Ian. We'll start with the Syria issue, which I think is sort of a stepping stone to the most serious topics, which are the possibility of Palestinian-Israeli peace and how to stop Iran from developing a nuclear bomb. But the Syria civil war, of course, cannot be ignored and would not have been ignored. The Israelis usually point to it as evidence that the Arab countries right now are so volatile that you should not expect Israel to make concessions and be in a rush toward negotiating peace. That's generally been the right-wing Israeli government's point of view, saying Egypt is in turmoil and Syria is in flames. We can't do anything. And this week, we get the chemical weapons issue, where each side in the civil war is accusing the other of using chemical weapons. U.S. intelligence is reluctant to confirm that occurred. Israeli intelligence also apparently reluctant, because as you say, one cabinet minister said, yes, somebody used chemical weapons, but the prime minister's office won't confirm that. But let's say it did happen. It would be something that brings the United States and Israel together. They both have said it violates a red line. It would destabilize the region for the Syrian government or anybody to use chemical weapons. It's not beyond the realm of possibility that U.S. or Israeli commando troops might enter Syria and seize those weapons. There would be action, but I think the bottom line is this, Ian. It's one of the issues that brings Obama and Netanyahu closer together. Some issues divide them, but Syria right now actually holds them together.
Even though it's out of control.
Well, they're not sure whom they favor. And, of course, you've noticed that the United States government, unlike some of the Europeans, doesn't want to send weapons to the rebels. The U.S. Government is just not certain who the rebels are. Some of them seem to be Islamic radicals who would be anti-American. And I have to tell you this, for a couple of years now, I've been asking Israeli intelligence officials, what do you think about Syria and whom do you favor? And they have been confused. It is one of the few topics where Israeli intelligence and the government don't know what they want the outcome to be. They don't like President Assad of Syria, and he, of course, hates Israel, but they figured him out years ago, he and his father. They must have the Syrian regime totally eavesdropped upon, totally monitored. And so the Israelis were kind of comfortable with the stalemate up there. The Israelis hate the current situation with a lot of dangers and insecurity. So they're not sure whom they favor at all.
Well, of course, the rebels, or at least a good part of them, accuse Assad of having been an Israeli agent, in effect.
Well, them saying that, of course, underlines that those rebels are very anti-Israeli, and by extension in the Middle East, that usually means you might be anti-American. So the United States isn't sure where it stands either. I mean, again, the Syria issue had to be brought up, and it might involve U.S. and Israeli joint action, but keep in mind that Syria's government has been very close with the Islamic Republic of Iran for many years. And in the Israeli view, you know, that's the big issue in the Mideast. And I think Barack Obama is coming around to that, too.
Well, but that raises the paradox, doesn't it, Dan Raviv, that if you intervened, or the West intervened, or Israel, or both intervened in Syria, it would be probably a blessing for Tehran. I mean, isn't the reality is that if Tehran loses Syria, it'll expose Hezbollah and basically reverse the so-called Shia Crescent. It will be a massive geopolitical reversal for Iran, or for this government of Iran.
Well, Ian, a lot of officials here in Washington, where I'm sitting right now, want Iran to be dealt a punch in the nose, you know, a major setback. And so they want the Syrian government to go down, but they're concerned about who would replace that government. Now, again, Syria is not the most important country in the world. And if Syria, you know, is run by Islamic Brotherhood followers, the U.S. probably can deal with that. They're dealing with an Islamic Brotherhood member who's the president of Egypt right now. For a lot of people, that punch in the nose to Iran would be the most powerful thing, and also weakening the Hezbollah faction in Lebanon, which, you know, has amassed tens of thousands of rockets for the next round between Lebanon and Israel. We had a war there in the summer of 06, and Israelis certainly think there's likely to be another round of warfare against Hezbollah at some point.
Again, I'm speaking with Dan Raviv, a national correspondent for CBS News and formerly a CBS correspondent in Tel Aviv. He's the author of several books, including the 1990 bestseller Every Spy a Prince, The Complete History of Israel's Intelligence Community, Friends Indeed Inside the U.S.-Israeli Alliance, and his latest Spies Against Armageddon, Inside Israel's Secret Wars, all co-authored with Israeli journalist Yossi Melman. Now, the president said today in Israel that across the region, the winds of change bring both promise and peril. And clearly, Israel's position strategically is very, very much affected by the Arab Spring. And it could get worse, particularly, for example, if the royal family in Jordan were to fall. How much do Israelis, because I think this is basically a public relations trip. There's not much policy going on. From what I can tell, it's in Netanyahu's interest to repair the relationship and make it clear that the U.S. and Israel are on the same page. And equally, I think Obama wants to repair the relationship because he has a problem with Congress. So if it's about PR and not about policy, how much do you think the Israeli people, I've heard that they in some ways blame Obama for what's happened in terms of the Arab Spring, in other words, giving permission to the Arab Spring, if you will.
Being too soft, not supporting Mubarak when he was president of Egypt, that sort of thing. But I have to disagree with your premise. I actually think that, almost like an iceberg, this Obama trip to the Middle East has 90% of its reality beneath the surface. I think there's a lot being discussed, including talking about what's going on with Iran's nuclear program, how best to counter it, reaching understandings over that. I believe that in the private talks between President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu, and they did have the talks and had a brief news conference afterward, that new understandings were reached. There will be a new strategic cooperation agreement between the U.S. and Israel being negotiated. That was said in public after the talks by President Obama. That's a major step forward, something that Israel really wants. There'll be more support for the Iron Dome anti-missile system. I think, in effect, the Israelis were saying, you know, we can't stand this uranium enrichment that Iran is still doing. We can't wait forever for diplomacy and sanctions to work. And you got to give us something so we feel safer. You have to stay our hand. And in effect, I think the United States has agreed, some of it behind closed doors, to a lot more strategic cooperation, that's military aid and intelligence exchanges. And I think that this, to tell you the truth, is what both leaders wanted. Obama wanted to prevent the outbreak of a war in the Middle East. Israel attacking Iran could cause a war. And Israel's leader with his new coalition, he wants to look closer to Obama and have some real help also for Israeli intelligence and the military. I think both men are getting what they wanted.
But it's a bit hard for me to understand, Dan Raviv, how you could have statements about how Hezbollah getting hold of Syria's chemical weapons could lead to an epic tragedy that we cannot allow.
Yeah.
And at the same time, saying that the greatest danger facing the Middle East was a nuclear Iran. To some extent, it seems that Prime Minister Netanyahu has been able to change the subject for a number of years.
Here's the main thing, Ian, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners are well aware of it. We haven't even mentioned Jewish settlements in the West Bank. We've barely mentioned the Palestinian issue.
Well, that's what I was about to say. He's managed to change the subject.
Changing the subject, right?
Right. So,
and of course, Netanyahu does not want to have his public disputes with Obama about that. And President Obama, after his first session with Netanyahu, and there will be more talks tomorrow and Friday, after the first session, there was no mention of settlements, but this is important. Tomorrow, President Obama is going to speak to the Israeli people. He's going to give a speech kind of over Netanyahu's head at a convention center called Binyanei HaUma in Jerusalem, mainly to university students. Obama, I think, is going to urge the Israeli people to see that they have to make peace with the Palestinians, that it's worth it to make major concessions, because that's the way to guarantee that Israel can exist as a Jewish and democratic state. I think he was saving it for tomorrow instead of ending up in a clash with Netanyahu today.
And tomorrow he also meets with the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas.
I think that's just a courtesy call. The truth is that Abbas is not very popular with the Obama administration. You'll recall that a few months ago, Abbas, the Palestinian, insisted on going to the UN in New York and getting and winning a vote, raising the recognition level for the Palestinians in the UN, kind of an independence vote. It made the Palestinians feel good, but the U.S. did not like it one bit. And so I don't think, in fact, that President Obama has much to give the Palestinian leader. Meantime, the Palestinian leader is trying to reconcile with Hamas, the radicals in Gaza. I see it as a courtesy call. I don't think much is going to happen there, but I do think it's significant that when he comes back to Jerusalem and speaks to the Israelis, Obama will tell Israel, for your own sake, negotiate with the Palestinians and reach an agreement.
Well, Abbas has been criticized recently, and I think in off the cuff, nevertheless, I think it reflects what King Abdullah of Jordan feels, that he has a problem with Abbas in as much as he says he's obsessed with the Israelis, but he doesn't even deal with the Palestinians. And you remember the big data dump, the leak, I think, to Al Jazeera that indicated that the Palestinians basically have gotten nowhere in the negotiations and haven't been particularly effective. So it's like everybody's piling on Abbas.
You know, Ian, you might have thought that the only way to achieve some peace between Israel and Palestine is to create both countries, have negotiations toward that end. There's a growing faction in Israel that says, let's take some unilateral steps. Let's decide and declare what the border is. Let's give land to the Palestinian Authority, but these people say, let's keep some of the land we captured in 1967, where the Jewish settlers, you know, are in these thickly populated settlements. Let's keep them. Let's draw a border. I don't think that's going to work, but that is a growing faction in Israel where people are also sick of the dispute. By the way, President Obama is going to visit King Hussein in Jordan Friday, and then Mr. Obama is going to go to Petra, that great archaeological site in Jordan, on Saturday before flying home. And I just want to say this. It looks like it's all PR and all image. I have evidence for you that it's not. And here we are. Michelle Obama is not on the trip. And I don't say that as a joke. If the First Lady were there, where she's a rock star around the world, that would mean that it was mostly for show. So you'd listen to music and deal with artists and eat the food and all that. No, I think there's a lot of substance because the Middle East is at a critical time. And it is even helpful that Obama visits Jordan because the king's position isn't that stable. And this will help firm up King Abdullah in Jordan.
Well, I hope you're right, and I hope I'm wrong.
yes, and by the way, we both might be right to a degree, because that's the Middle East for you, right? You get a little pattern where for 6 months things seem encouraging, and then it goes the other way, but we can't take our eye off the ball there. It's just too volatile.
So, Dan Raviv, you have obviously, with the books that you've done with Yossi Melman on intelligence, Israeli intelligence, and the relationship between the U.S. and Israel, the latest being Spies Against Armageddon, Inside Israel's Secret Wars, you would be the best person to answer a question I have, which is, what is this obsession that the Israelis have with Jonathan Pollard, with getting him out of jail?
I mean, a question of loyalty. In fact, I'll tell you. I mean, he's an American who was captured, arrested in Washington, D.C. in 1985. So he's been held for 28 years. He was found guilty of spying for the Israelis in Washington, D.C. He had access to secrets as a naval intelligence civilian worker. Okay, so he got a life sentence. He's of course, been complaining about it, as has his family from the very beginning. For a while, Israel said nothing. They were ashamed at having been caught. In fact, they gave U.S. prosecutors quite a lot of evidence that went against Pollard. Well, in the last 10 years or so, Israeli governments feel really bad about that, and I really mean it on a human level. Israel has a tradition of going behind enemy lines, whatever is necessary, even trading 1,000 Palestinian prisoners to get one Israeli captured soldier released. And so they're seeing Pollard now as one of their guys who was captured in the United States, and Israel abandoned him, and the current Israeli government really wants to get him out. And there's a large movement in Israel calling for that. I don't think Obama's going to do it anytime soon. The CIA is dead set against it. But maybe in a while. As I say, Pollard, who's now 58 years old, has been in an American jail, a prison now, for 28 years.
Well, it's just that I brought it up because there are Israelis staging protests in Jerusalem demanding that President Obama free Jonathan Pollard. And more recently, I covered a story that involved an Australian Israeli who was disappeared into a secret prison where he committed suicide under mysterious circumstances.
Sure, I covered that too. And at IsraelSpy.com, my co-author and I write a lot about the Australian fella who was a Mossad operative who worked overseas and somehow did something against the agency where they locked him up. They were going to put him on trial, but before they could get to the trial, he apparently committed suicide in a high-security prison cell. A lot of shadowy stories about Israeli intel. In the case of Pollard, he's the only Israeli spy arrested in the U.S. ever, and the Israelis used to hate to talk about it, but now they've decided to publicly campaign and ask for his release. I don't think it'll happen now, but we'll see, maybe in the next few years.
But in terms of humanitarianism, there's a kind of irony there with Pollard and with the Australian fellow.
I take your point, but I did my best to check on the Australian case, and Israeli intelligence and the prosecutors and the Prime Minister's office did not want Ben Zigir to kill himself. They wanted to lock him up in secret, punish him for maybe 10 or 12 years in prison. That's the kind of sentence they had in mind for whatever his violation was. And no one is revealing what he did that made the Mossad so angry. But they were going to lock him up, and after 12 years, they thought they'd let him out. It's happened before. Instead, he foiled all that by killing himself.
So just in closing then, Dan Revie, back to the trip, which you've suggested there's quite a lot going on behind the scenes, mm-hmm. and it may be a very substantive, in effect, a working trip, not a PR trip.
I think so.
But what's going to be the takeaway? Because, you know, we've had this thing called a peace process, but it has little or nothing to do with peace. The agony goes on. At times, you know, you feel like this situation needs adult supervision. And the only adult in the room, or that could be in the room, is the United States. Mm-hmm. And we've had sort of fits and starts of American presidents getting things done over there, but mostly failing. So what's your prognosis on whether they can get a deal so that we don't have to keep talking about Israel all the time?
Well, Secretary of State John Kerry does plan to roll up his sleeves and get involved and meet with both Israeli and Palestinian leaders starting next week. And so there's no special envoy for the Obama administration, but there is the Secretary of State. I think he's going to rapidly find that that conditions are not ripe. The Palestinian movement is so divided with Hamas in the Gaza Strip and the more moderate Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. I don't think there's anything there. As for Israelis, well, they have a new coalition government. It's a mix of people. Some are a little softer on keeping the West Bank. Some are more hardline and pro-settler. You don't have the extreme Orthodox Jewish parties in a coalition with Netanyahu anymore. He excluded them. So there are possibilities for change, but frankly, I don't think there's enough goodwill. And as for adult supervision, you cannot force the two sides. So right now, with all that's going on in the Middle East, including the Iranian nuclear threat, as it's perceived, especially by Israel, you're not going to find the Israeli government in a mood to make major concessions. And therefore, I'm afraid we're going to have stalemate still between Israel and the Palestinians.
But just in closing, though, just because we're observing the 10th anniversary of the beginning of the Iraq War, what kind of soul-searching is going on in Israel? Because there was tremendous support for George W. Bush and for that war initially, at least, although I did speak with the Israeli military historian Martin Van Creewald, who referred to the invasion of Iraq is the worst strategic mistake since Emperor Augustus invaded Germany in 9 AD. But given how much the chips have fallen in many ways and how unstable that region is as a result of that war, and it's likely to get worse, my understanding is that if Assad falls, it could have the ripple effect of ungluing what is being held together by a shoestring in Iraq.
Yeah, more volatility, as you say. Okay, here's the Israeli intelligence view of the Iraq war. They say that 10 years ago, the U.S. asked them a little bit for advice, and the Israeli advice was, this is really messy. You know, Bush, Cheney, you're a very friendly administration. You might not want to do this because it could end up strengthening Iran. But according to the Israelis, the Bush-Cheney team really was intent on doing it. So the Israelis said, yeah, well, we hate Saddam Hussein. You go ahead. All through the war in Iraq, the Israelis just really kept their distance. They sold some equipment, maybe, to help the U.S. Special Forces, but they kept their distance. The Israelis were thrilled when the U.S. got Osama bin Laden, and among other things, the Israelis would like the U.S. to keep fighting terrorists, keep fighting al-Qaeda. But yep, Iraq was a mistake, and it caused more instability. But Israelis say, we always live with instability. Every 10 years, it's a new picture. That, for a right-wing Israeli government, a guy like Prime Minister Netanyahu, is always the excuse for not making concessions. He says the whole neighborhood is too dangerous. So I expect Netanyahu to keep saying just that.
Well, Dan Raviv, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian.
I've been speaking with Dan Raviv, who's a national correspondent for CBS News and formerly CBS correspondent in Tel Aviv. He's the author of several books, including the 1990 bestseller Every Spy a Prince, The Complete History of Israel's Intelligence Community, Friends Indeed Inside the U.S.-Israel Alliance, and his latest Spies Against Armageddon, Inside Israel's Secret Wars, all co-authored with Israeli journalist Yossi Melman. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about how student loan debt has now passed the $1 trillion mark.
So you gotta hang on till tomorrow. Come what may. Tomorrow, tomorrow, I love ya. Tomorrow, you're always a day away.
Just a good. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by. And feed them on your dreams. The one they picked, the one you know by.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me now is David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously founding director of Campus Progress and senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Mitch Daniels and Mike Mullen Should Tell For-Profit Colleges Hard Truths or Else Stay Away. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Halperin.
Thanks, Ian. Always good to be on with you.
And David, last week, the nation's college loan bill stood at more than $1 trillion, meaning that the average college graduate leaves school with a debt of $26,000. And this is almost tripled since 2004. What's been happening since 2004?
Well, basically two things. It's pretty simple. College costs too much, and jobs are scarce and don't pay enough. So students take on debt, they graduate or they drop out, they owe a lot of money, and they can't find jobs that allow them to pay back their loans fast enough or pay them back at all.
But surely, since you've worked in the national security field, isn't this a national security issue? This means that the generations, particularly the millennials now, they apparently are not going to have the savings for retirement or owning. They won't have the ability to own a, a house or a car. And a recent report released by the Urban Institute says that people under the age of 40 have a significantly lower net worth than anyone their age did 30 years ago. So we're not investing in future generations.
We're not investing in future generations. And we're also engaged in the United States in policies that have reduced jobs in the United States, and particularly, I believe now, trade agreements that have had the effect of shipping our jobs overseas. The unchecked power of corporations in Washington to get what they want, which often diminishes the wages, the power of workers, of unions, and of all workers. And it means that people are going into a job market that is part-time jobs, jobs without health insurance, jobs that don't pay as well as people's parents' jobs paid. And there are no savings for young people. The government is not investing in education, and it's not investing in jobs. And it's leading us, some of it is structural and perhaps some of it is inevitable, but some of it is deliberate decisions that we're making that is making life harder at a very basic level for people who are trying to improve their lives and the lives of their families.
Well, something happened in this period where student loan debt has tripled, and that is that these students cannot discharge these loans through bankruptcy. The only way they can get out of it is to die, apparently. And yeah, without the threat of being able to file for bankruptcy, student loan debtors, unlike people who've maxed out their credit cards, are unable to negotiate with their lenders.
Yeah, and in fact, private student loans, the loans that are not guaranteed by the government and that come with a higher interest rate and are made by most of the big banks that are powerful in Washington and on Wall Street, those loans were at one time dischargeable in bankruptcy, but they are no longer. And some senators have introduced a bill to try to make them dischargeable again, because that would be, we're not in favor of people borrowing money that they can't pay back, but sometimes there's just no alternative, as you say, sometimes leverage with creditors is important. And also, very importantly, a lot of times students have taken on enormous amounts of the private, high-interest student loan debt because they've been misled about their educational prospects, largely by, as you know, one of my least favorite subjects, for-profit colleges that engage in coercive and deceptive recruiting, sell students the moon, and then leave them deep in debt with poor quality education and poor prospects for getting a good job.
Well, the senators that introduced that legislation are Al Franken and Tom Harkin to try and restore the rights of graduates to discharge private education loans. But I take it somebody recently did the opposite, right?
Because 2005 was when Congress decided to make those loans non-dischargeable in bankruptcy, and they did it because the friendly lobbyists who the for-profit colleges and the banks can afford to hire to come around and say this is good for America, good for you, but mostly it's just good for giving them more campaign contributions so they can run again and continue to serve often at the pleasure of their benefactors who give them the campaign contributions. So it's a bad situation, and many bad situations that people face in their daily lives today, from declining wages, from the prevalence of these for-profit colleges, to other horrible things like environmental destruction, are because lobbyists in Washington and corporations in Washington simply have too much power right now in the political process.
Again, I'm speaking with David Halperin, who's a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously founding director of Campus Progress and senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Mitch Daniels and Mike Mullen Should Tell For-Profit Colleges Hard Truths or else stay away. Let's deal with that issue. The trade group then for the for-profit college is called the APSCU. At their annual convention, the last annual convention, they paid George W. Bush, obviously, a good fee, and this Michelle Rhee, this woman who poses as somebody that cares about education, and gets a lot of media attention. They are meeting this year, and they're going to feature former Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels and retired chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mike Mullen, along with Cool in the Gang. So your piece in the Huffington Post is saying
it's
to
not
the,
even all of Cool in the Gang. It's mostly just Cool and some other people who are now with him.
Oh, I see. So they're even ripping you off with the entertainment, right?
They're not spending money on an even more expensive band because their whole conference is paid for by our tax dollars.
Explain that. They're all basically...
Because most of the big for-profit colleges, as Senator Harkin's comprehensive report from last year documented, get around 86% of their revenue from you and me, from the taxpayer.
So they get the taxpayers' money, and then they charge it back to these students who they indenture for life and provide them with worthless diplomas so that they can't get a job.
Yes. $33 billion a year of your tax money goes to federal financial aid to put students in for-profit colleges. If you think about the entire budget of the Homeland Security Department, I believe is something like $80 billion. So almost half of what we spend on all of the Homeland Security enforcement that we have in this country is spent on that, and most of it is worthless, because worse than worthless. We'd be better off, in some respects, throwing a lot of that money in the river, because not only does the money get wasted, it is used to systematically ruin the lives of students who come in, promise that they will have great careers. They end up in deep debt themselves. They end up embarrassed, frustrated, disappointed, confused about what has happened to them. These are low-income people, single mothers, veterans, people of color, the people who are former offenders, immigrants. And most of these people have a bad experience with these schools. These schools have grown dramatically, for-profit colleges. I'm talking about the University of Phoenix and the art institutes. And these kinds of schools, they have grown dramatically. They have 13% now of all college and training school students in the United States, but their financial footprint is much bigger than that. They're getting 25% now of all of the federal financial aid, loans and grants guaranteed by the federal government, and they account for 47% of all the defaults on loans, meaning that a far higher percentage of these students end up being broke, being unable to pay back their loans because, again, the prices are high and the quality of the education is low. So you end up paying a lot and then you can't get a good job, you can't pay it back. So when you think about the problem of student debt, for-profit colleges are a huge part of it and a part that we could correct if members of Congress had the courage to stand up to their lobbyists and say, no more of this, strict accountability, we're only going to fund financial aid at schools that are sincerely helping students to build careers, to learn, to get jobs. And schools that are not should be cut off from this program. We could make a huge, huge dent in this problem and start channeling more of the money to programs that help students and do a lot more to keep students out of the deep debt that's caused by them if we address. Now, there are problems with public schools and private schools that are nonprofit as well. But a huge problem that we have is these for-profit colleges that have amassed so much money and so much power, and then they are able to invite people to their conference, like this year, like Michelle Rhee, who claimed she was going to read them the Riot Act after I called her out for doing this, and instead she went in, we secretly taped her talk, and she said nothing. She barely said anything critical of them. This year they have Admiral Mullen, who was supposed to stand up for education of the troops when he was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And they've actually said on their website what a feather it is in their cap and how it will increase their prestige to have him speak. Well, if he doesn't tell them that they're systematically ripping off our troops and veterans, then he's letting them down. And Mitch Daniels, former governor of Indiana, supposedly a spokesperson and a champion of limited government, is going in to pat on the back this industry, which is systematically wasting your taxpayer dollars to the tune of $33 billion a year.
Well, David Halperin, all you have to do is watch television to see the blizzard of advertising from these for-profit colleges, and every day there's a new one, like Capella is all over the airwaves now. And people who see those advertisements on television ought to realize it's your money that's paying for those advertisements, because you're underwriting these rip-off operations to the tune of 86%, and they spend enormous amounts of money on advertising. In order to get these kids, to con them into these damn worthless diploma mills in the first place. But you just brought up the ripping off the troops, which is a real sore spot. Last year at Fort Stewart, Georgia, President Obama warned our military service members that some for-profit colleges aren't interested in helping you. They're interested in getting the money. And he called those schools' conduct, their schools' conduct, disgraceful. And he told the troops that these schools are trying to swindle and hoodwink you. And then on top of that, Holly Petraeus, the wife of General Petraeus, who directs Service Members Affairs at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the new bureau that the Republicans have been trying to shut down, she said that predatory for-profit colleges see service members as nothing more than dollar signs in uniforms. So you've got really prominent people speaking up. How come the public aren't aware of this?
Well, I think it's somewhat under the radar still for the public. It seems like a kind of confusing issue. But the good news is, in a sense, more even though we haven't been able to defeat the lobbyists and get change in Washington on holding these schools accountable, the students are starting to get the message. Even students that, you know, who come from, you know, backgrounds where they may not always be, you know, getting all the most recent news from Washington, are getting the message that these a lot of these schools are a ripoff, and they're voting with their feet, and enrollment is down at many of the for-profit colleges, and they're scrambling. But unfortunately, they're not. Most of them do not seem to be saying, how can we now figure out how to change our business model and make money while actually helping students? Instead, they're continuing to fight. They're fighting in court. They won another victory today on paralyzing the Obama regulations on for-profit colleges. They're fighting against a bill you mentioned, marketing. Senator Hagan from North Carolina, Senator Harkin have introduced a bill saying schools can't use your tax dollars to pay for marketing. But since they get so much of their money from their tax dollars, and since they spend so much on marketing, the schools are against that. They're fighting against it, and they're saying everyone should be able to get as much information as they can from television, the internet. So it would be a terrible burden on us to have a bill that restricted our marketing. They keep on fighting. They keep on trying to find ways to obfuscate and to keep the truth from coming out. But the main thing they need to do, which they've done successfully, is funnel those campaign contributions to Washington. And people out there listening should be outraged and should be asking their member of Congress, do you stand with the people in your district, the veterans, the low-income people, the people striving to have a better life who have been victimized and preyed on by these for-profit colleges, or do you stand with the wealthy for-profit colleges and their lobbyists in Washington who are contributing to your campaign? Members ought to stand up and say, no more of this. I stand with my constituents and not with these bankers and hucksters out there that are ruining people's lives and wasting our tax money.
And, of course, we don't need the ex-chairman of the Joint Chiefs shilling for them. And I recall that the payday loan predators, which were preying on military bases, at least the Congress removed them from military bases. So thank you very much for joining us, David Halperin.
Thank you for having me again, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously founding director of Campus Progress and senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Mitch Daniels and Mike Mullen Should Tell For-Profit Colleges Hard Truths or Else Stay Home. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. An angel song about the home of the brave and this land here under the free. One time.